welcome to That's Spooky. I'm Johnny.
And I'm Tyler.
And this is a weekly podcast also known as Murder, He Squealed.
Murder!
Oh my god! So I guess we should just get it out of the way.
Get what out of the way?
2 to 3 to 4 minutes of Drag Race, of course.
Adoy. How could I forget?
Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Never been here before. First time.
Cool. Well, we do this thing called Spooky Gay Bullshit, and we usually start it by talking about Drag Race, because that's the gay thing.
Right.
Yeah. So, high points, low points?
Okay. So, my high point for this week was our girl Akiria finally got some recognition for being a fierce bitch, and she won that competition.
Yeah, she was so good this week. That face that she served during the challenge.
Yeah.
Put me to bed.
Yes, absolutely. And like Akiria has been really doing it for me all season long. She has great talking heads. Mm-hmm. She's very entertaining. She has great looks on the runway, like really good.
Except that Pisces look.
What was the Pisces? Okay.
Yeah. But aside from that, she has been silent but deadly all season.
Yes.
But not silent because, like you said, her talking heads are great.
Definitely, yeah. But she just kind of laid low among some of the bigger personalities of the season. So I was glad that her talent was really recognized and really celebrated this week. So woo. That was my high point.
Yes, Akiria, that's our girl. All right. Well, I would have to say that my high point this week would be the appearance of Love Connie.
Mm-hmm.
Love Connie is so good. Oh my God. She finally got her moment on Drag Race. She was there to like facilitate the mini challenge. She did like a twisted Jane Fonda workout challenge with them. It was so good.
Yeah.
Just go on YouTube, go look up videos of Love Connie performing. It's like full throttle skag drag dance at its finest.
Yeah, it was so good. And girl, that was also one of the meatiest tucks I have ever seen. I don't even know if it could be classified as a tuck. It was so meaty.
And that's the point. And that's why I fucking love Connie.
Yeah.
Also, fun fact, watch Legally Blonde. Love Connie is totally that guy in the hair salon that's like the bend and snap works every time.
No fucking way.
Yeah, same dude. Yeah.
I quote that weekly.
Yeah, the bitch has been around for a while. So that was definitely my high point of the week. Low points?
Low point. So Lil Miss Vanjie broke my heart this week.
Aww.
You know, she's been so confident. She's been so out there. And then this week, she just kind of stumbled and is like, am I doing enough? Like, what more can I do? Feeling like she was kind of falling back on her skills. You know what I mean?
We had a moment when the voice dropped away.
I know. That was kind of disorienting.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, she got real vulnerable this week. And it was kind of sad to see because these are these big, boisterous personalities that we turn to get joy from, to kind of escape our bad feelings, escape our like shitty days. And then here they are having a shitty day of their own. You know what I mean?
Totally. Like it's completely within their right to have a bad day. But it's just one of those things like when you see your favorite having a rough moment, you're like, oh, baby, let me hug you.
Yeah, for sure. But I'm sure this is probably just going to be a wake-up call for her. I'm sure she's going to snap back into it. She's going to serve it. But I guess she does kind of need to spice it up on the runway a little bit.
Yeah.
If she wants to really bring that wow.
She'll get it. All right. Well, I would have to say the Milo point was I watched my favorite kind of have a hard moment, you know?
I know exactly what you're talking about. Evie Oddly Mama.
Yeah. So they've been kind of discussing on the show over the last 2 weeks how Evie suffers from Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And that results in a lack of collagen being produced by her body, which gives her, you know, flexibility. But at the same time can also lead to joints popping out of place and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I was really sad to see like one missed step in the challenge lead to Evie getting injured. And it really put my heart in my asshole because I was like, no, please don't get sent home over a fucking injury.
Right.
But then on the flip side of this, like, I really hope that even if there is something wrong with her ankle, they keep her in the competition.
Yes.
Because I think that this could be a really cool moment for the show to say, look, just because you have a difference in mobility right now, it doesn't mean that you can't go up there and serve it just as fiercely as any other queen.
Yes, ma'am. That's a great point.
So, regardless, I hope that she heals up by the next episode. I know this is pre-taped, so no amount of thoughts and prayers can do anything to fix the situation.
No, but next week is a design challenge, so she will get that rest that she was saying she needed. And Mama says she was a fast healer.
Mm-hmm. And she is brilliant and creative. So, she's gonna win. I'm just saying, trust me, I'm a witch.
I know these things.
I know these things.
You're a regular old Helen Duncan mama.
Basically, mystic sneezes and all. Speaking of being a witch, we should just get into the rest of spooky gay bullshit.
Yes.
Okay, so you've got something to bring to the table?
I do, and witches actually have a little something to do with this story.
Ooh.
So, last week there was a priest from a Catholic parish in Poland who organized a book burning.
What? Those are so passe.
So passe. So, parishioners from the religious organization SMS from Heaven.
What? Like, yeah. Text message from heaven?
That's what I thought. I actually don't know what SMS stands for, but I want to keep believing that that's what it means. So, yes.
Girl, yeah.
Text messages from heaven. Anyway, this group posted photos on Facebook where books and other objects were burnt on display.
They were sharing it on Facebook?
They were sharing it all over Facebook, and they were putting Bible verses underneath the posts, all of these things. Anyway, the items were brought in by the parishioners after the priests encouraged them to empty their homes of evil objects.
Girl.
Yes. So some of these objects included a tribal mask.
Of course.
Elephant statues.
Oh my.
And even Hindu figures.
Oh my God.
Right?
How dare they?
And they also burnt a bunch of Harry Potter and Twilight books.
Girl, you are like 15 years late on burning Harry Potter, let me tell you that.
But that's exactly it. This is like not new behavior from like religious extremists burning the Harry Potter books because witchcraft and wizardry and magic is evil.
Yeah, girl, get it together.
Yeah, seriously. Now, I can get on board with burning the Twilight books because, I mean, really, come on.
Sure.
But after these posts surfaced on the internet, a lot of people had a lot of things to say.
Well, I can imagine the internet had a thing or two to say about this.
Yeah.
As a child of the internet, I have a thing or two to say about this.
That's the tea. So eventually the posts were all taken down off of Facebook, and the priest who called for the burning later apologized, writing that he was very sorry and that the act of book burning was unfortunate. But then he also went on to specify that it wasn't an attack on culture or the books, just specifically evil.
So just on the subject matter.
Just on the subject matter of evil, yes. And magic and witchcraft just happens to be one of those subject matters.
So he basically didn't apologize for burning the books. It was kind of an I'm sorry if you're offended situation.
I'm sorry if you misunderstood.
Mm-hmm. This was a symbolic act. We weren't really coming for intellectualism. Just fucking bravo.
Right?
Yeah, you totally want to be the guy that's remembered for burning books and 2019.
Definitely. And like, even just beyond burning the Harry Potter books, because like, whatever, the fact that they were burning tribal masks and Hindu sculptures is super ignorant and super problematic.
Yeah, unless they were just like, look, cultural appropriation is a real problem. Stop using other people's religions as decorations for your home. Like, that could be understandable, but even then, just take it away from them. You don't need to destroy this shit.
Right? Why does it have to be set on fire?
Have you never seen Trading Spaces or While You Were Out or any of these fucking shows? You create one pile to give away to Goodwill, you create one pile to keep, and then you create another pile to burn.
Exactly.
There are three options.
Three piles, three options. Get it together.
Yeah, not just keep or burn, you dumb shit. Oops, sorry, did I just call a man of the cloth a dumb shit?
Uh-oh.
Ooh, hot take.
So anyway, I came across that story and just thought it was stupid as fuck and thought y'all might want to hear about this book burning in 2019.
Fair enough. And by the way, we're not coming for Christianity or anything like that. We're just coming for dumb people that burn books. Just in the same way that the priest wanted to make sure that we knew that he wasn't coming for literacy, just Harry Potter, we just wanted to clarify that nuance as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's equal parts stupid and horrifying.
Yes.
Great. Do you have any oopsie poopsies this week?
This week, I don't think I do have any oopsie poopsies. I think I said every name pretty much well. I think I managed to say Helen every single time I meant to say Helen.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
Wow, yeah.
Do you have any oopsie poopsies?
I don't think I do. I'm pretty sure, unless the mannequins had names that I wasn't aware of, I'm pretty sure I spelled it all out.
Right, yeah. Pool mannequins, check. Big ol' check.
Girl, it's not even like a check. It's like pool mannequins, submit the test.
Yeah, exactly.
Written, wrote, and done. All right, well, I'm going first this week, right?
Yes, because I went first last week, and that's what we're doing.
And it's only fair.
Yes.
So today I'm going to be talking about, I guess you could say, the mysterious case of Estefania Gutierrez Lazaro.
Okay.
Have you ever seen the movie Veronica?
Oh, bitch, yes. Is this the story?
Oh, yeah, baby.
Ooh, mama.
Get into it. So, the really notable thing about this case is that it's one of the few paranormal instances, and kind of the most popular paranormal instance that's come out of Spain, that's been documented by the police.
Right.
Yeah. So, this gets real crazy real fast. The whole story starts in 1990 in Madrid, Spain. So, it's the Gutierrez Lazaro family. They live in a condo at 8 Louis Marin in Velázquez, Madrid. Maximo is the father, Concepcion is the mother, Estefania is the oldest daughter, and then they have two younger daughters. We don't know their names.
Okay.
And then they have one son named Maximilian, who's a bit of a baby while all this is going on.
Right.
Emotionally and physically. So it all starts when Concepcion's father is dying in the hospital. So grandpa on his deathbed.
Right.
She brings the children to go see grandpa one more time. This is usually a really sad moment. Everyone usually wants to say goodbye and, you know, have their last moment. Although, you know what, you can't speak for somebody in that moment, because I know some people who'd be like, get me the fuck out of here.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. People deal with death in their own different ways, and there is no right and there is no wrong way to do that.
Yeah, but in this case, it was really just a formality for the whole family to go say goodbye to grandpa. He wasn't really the nicest guy. In fact, he hated the entire family.
Oh. Oh, well then, bye, bitch.
Yeah, it's not just like that one Trump-supporting family member that everyone's just like, ugh, we're fucking over him.
Right.
He was just straight up like, I fucking hate you all. I'll see you in hell. And basically, as he's saying goodbye to all of his family members, he pulls Estefania in real close. And his last words to her were, if I cannot harm you in this life, I will do it in the next one.
Are you fucking kidding me?
No. And then shortly thereafter, he died.
That's fucking terrifying.
What a fucking way to say goodbye to your grandfather.
Eternal mindfuck. She'll think about that forever.
Yeah, for the rest of her fucking life. So Estefania is about like 17 years old at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just say it resonates with her.
Yeah.
And to throw a pickle on the shit sandwich, a few months later, the boyfriend of one of Estefania's friends dies in a motorcycle accident.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, cue the Dawson's Creek theme music.
Actually, if we're being real, it sounds more like the OC than Dawson's Creek.
I have no reference point for the OC, so I will take you on that one.
It's there, mama. Trust and believe.
I thought I was way too cool for the OC at the time, so I never dipped my toe in it.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and now I just sit here and it's like I have no reason to go back and watch it, because everyone that was like, it's amazing at the time, is now like, no, girl, don't no go there. So now I'm just like, well, I guess it was good that I was a pretentious fuck in that moment.
Yeah, just get a supercut on YouTube. You'll get the idea.
Yeah, I know somebody got shot to an Imogen Heap song.
Yes, and then the next season, that person died in a car crash.
Love it.
Drama.
But that didn't make as good of a meme as the Imogen Heap theme song coming with the gunshot after things.
Yeah, not at all.
Regardless of my favorite memes, though, Estefania's friend group, pretty broken up about the loss of this guy.
Sure.
Yeah, so what is a grieving teenager to do? Well, a few months after he dies, Estefania and a few of her good Judies decide while at school to mock up a good old Ouija board, take a glass, and pull their own seance during lunch.
In my unsubstantiated opinion, wrong move.
And to be fair, it doesn't really go that well. So they get in there, they've got their cup, they have their makeshift Ouija board, and they're like, hello, Satan, are you there? It's me, Estefania. Stefania. All of a sudden, one of the teacher nuns from the school shows up and breaks up that party.
Party crashed.
Very much so. So not only does she rip up the Ouija board, but she throws the glass onto the ground and it shatters. When the glass shatters, the girls that Estefania is with see a smoke rise up from the glass and go into Estefania's mouth and nose.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, so she breathes in this spooky smoke and the nun basically just pulls them by their ear back into the school. Not a really slick move, because the problem was they were contacting something and they didn't say bye-bye to it.
You always gotta say bye-bye. Manners are very important in the spirit world.
I was gonna say, welcome to Demons 101. Niceties are first and foremost a priority.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever that demon smoke was that Veronica inhaled stuck with her.
She had the case of the demonitis.
Mm-hmm. She had the ghost lung.
Oh my god, yes.
She's been working hard down in those ghost mines, and all of a sudden she got that ghost lung.
She got that ghost lung, and they don't compensate the ghost lung.
And that's why you don't go mining for ghosts. So from that point forward, things just get worse for Estefania. Like, not only is it bad enough that your grandpa cursed you with his dying breath, and then you lose somebody in your friend group, and like, that's hard for anybody, but that's hard for a teenager. I lost a friend at 17.
That's right, you did.
Yeah, it fucks with your head. And then on top of that, a nun breaks up your demon kiki.
Ooh.
Not a good time. So basically, to throw some chips on the side of that shit sandwich with a pickle, Estefania starts experiencing convulsions and starts to see visions. And everyone's just like, oh, you're so crazy.
Estefania, you so crazy with your random convulsions and your ghost lung.
Yeah, and according to Concepcion, Estefania's mother, Estefania started to be stalked by shadowy figures. Mm-hmm. Supposedly, it was a group of them that I guess they thought were like impoverished souls, and they would just constantly be like reaching out to her, being like, oh, save us, Estefania, but like not verbalizing it. So just imagine like walking through your life and then suddenly there are a bunch of like shadowy figures like full on lay mizzing at you.
I can't imagine it, and I hate it. Now, was she the only person that could see these shadow figures, or could her family member, like her mom, also see these shadow figures?
Oh no, it was totally just Estefania seeing this.
Okay.
Yeah, so what's a girl to do? Over time, Estefania starts to become increasingly violent with her family.
Right.
Yeah, so her personality just all of a sudden really starts to shift. She's seeing these people. She's falling down into convulsive fits. And then suddenly she would start violently attacking her family out of nowhere, completely blacked out, like not knowing what's going on. She would just be like raging and yelling at them with this hoarse voice that they said sounded like a man. And then she would be like hurling out insults. And then she would like fall to the floor. And then when she would come back to, she would have no recollection of the events.
Right. Sounds like grandpa's fucking some shit up.
Yeah. Also sounds like being a teenager.
Yeah.
I can totally identify. Your voice starts changing. Mm-hmm. You're swearing at your family and you don't know why. It's a thing.
You're making all kinds of strange friends that your family doesn't approve of. For sure. Sounds like adolescence to me.
Anyway, so it essentially gets worse for Estefania. Her family witnesses her body going like really rigid during these convulsion fits, and mm-hmm. her eyes going just pure white.
Shit.
Like not even rolling into the back of her head, just like fogging over and turning white. And then she would start foaming at the mouth.
Fuck.
Yeah, so they're like, what is up? This is so not hot.
Yeah, no.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what about the shadow people?
Well, they're no help. In fact, they're still just like, oh, come save us. Because, you know, like, freeloading shadow people.
Right.
And they start getting even more menacing. So, basically, just, like, everything that Estefania had been afflicted with turns up to fucking 11.
Right. So, she's going through all of this stuff herself. She has these needy shadow people that want them to help her. She doesn't know how to help her. She doesn't even know what she's doing. And all hell is breaking loose.
Yeah. And then they just spinal tap it up another notch. So Estefania's mother decides to go out and seek medical treatment for Estefania. Problem was, when she took Estefania to doctors, they weren't able to find out what was wrong with her. Like, they could not link it back to anything biological.
Now ask me if I'm surprised.
Are you surprised?
No.
Fair enough. Now, the thing is, some of the symptoms did point toward epilepsy. They were like, well, she's falling into convulsions, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Problem is, from what I understand at the time, epilepsy was kind of hard to like fully diagnose.
Right.
Like seizures don't always equal full on epilepsy.
Right.
The problem is, though, you can also look at that on the other side and be like, well, they may have just misdiagnosed her and not picked up on the fact that she had a form of epilepsy that they may not have fully understood. And essentially it went untreated.
Right.
Because all of the doctors were just like, well, we don't exactly know what it is. You're having these symptoms. We can't link it to anything on a larger scale. Sorry about it, girl.
Right. So they couldn't necessarily determine what it was, but they couldn't rule out certain things either.
Yeah. And then there was also a small fraction of doctors who were like, well, you're experiencing a psychotic break.
Which sounds plausible because it does seem like she did go through a lot of recent trauma with her grandfather, with her friend.
Yeah. The other small fraction of doctors were like, well, maybe you're possessed.
Uh-huh. In this case, I think I run with those doctors.
Yeah, so cue the piano music in a minor key. Unfortunately, despite the best efforts of her mother, Estefania basically would just keep on experiencing these signs of possession and not get any medical treatment for it. Fast forward to August of 1991, Estefania tells her family that the shadow people that she's been seeing are now asking her to come with them.
Like where?
Holiday.
Right? Like on a cruise?
Basically, I don't know. Like just come on to the spirit world, baby.
No, ma'am. The spirit world is not invite only.
Yeah, off limits. While you are living under this roof, you will not be going to the other side. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Problem was there wasn't much that Concepcion or Maximo could do about it, because within a matter of days, on August 14th of 1991, Estefania fell into a coma and had to be admitted to the local hospital.
Whoa.
Shortly after arriving at the hospital, Estefania just died.
What the fuck?
Yeah, like very mysteriously, they couldn't figure out what the cause was, but she just slipped into a coma and died.
Damn.
Yeah, don't worry, it gets worse. So according to the doctors, they're completely stumped. They take samples of her organ tissue and they send it off for testing. Everything comes back clean. They could not link this to a disease. They could not link it to a seizure that was going on at the time or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It basically just seems like this girl all of a sudden just slipped off this mortal coil. Wasn't that poetic of me?
Yeah.
Aren't you proud? I think this podcast is really having an impact.
Should we rename this podcast? Can we call it This Mortal Coil?
Yeah, or we could call it Men Getting Poetic.
Perfect. That's what the world needs. More men getting poetic.
Yeah, let's bring back the man show. Really flip it on its head. Do you remember that?
Oh, I do, and it was awful. I think every episode they had a segment of women jumping on a trampoline. Like, they need to repent for that show for the rest of their fucking lives.
Yeah, I definitely remember watching it when I was younger, just being like, this is what it means to be a straight man. If I laugh at this, then I fit in with straight men. Ha ha ha, I love the man show, it's so funny.
Right, well, aren't you glad you're not a straight man?
You know what? Every morning I wake up, I walk to the bathroom, I draw a heart on the mirror and toothpaste over my heart, I put my palm up to the mirror where that heart was drawn, and I smear it around and I say, thank God I'm not straight.
And then, God damn it, I have to clean up this toothpaste.
Yeah, and then I say, thank God I'm a big old fat fag. And then I slap my face with that toothpaste hand and I'm ready to start my day.
Wow.
I know.
I did not know this about you.
That's why I always smell like spearmint.
Perfect.
Yeah, so back to Estefania. She dies. Doctors can't find anything wrong. The family is absolutely heartbroken and super confused about what the fuck is going on.
Yeah, and now I'm also super confused as to how this is supposed to get worse.
Well, the Gutierrez-Lazaro family is mourning the loss of their eldest daughter, and then on top of that, they start getting haunted by the spirits that she was being haunted by.
She didn't take them with her.
Nuh-uh. In fact, she just joined them. So, for a number of months following Estefania's death, the family just starts reporting all of these paranormal incidences. Like, every person in the family ended up experiencing shit in the house that was akin to what Estefania was going through prior to her death.
Shit.
Thanks, Grandpa. So within days of Estefania dying, the family starts to hear a disembodied voice coming from Estefania's room, which they had closed up and just been kind of keeping tidy since everything went down.
Yeah.
Calling out, saying, Mama, Mama.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and then they would go in to to check and there would be nobody there. Then all of a sudden the family starts to hear knocks on the door coming from inside Estefania's room. Every time they would go in, check, and there would be nobody there. Until one time Concepcion goes down to check. She looks in the room and all of Estefania's possessions are thrown around the room. The bedding has been torn off the bed, but there's no sign of any person in the room. And none of the family members had gone in the room, like they were all in mourning. Nobody would have done this shit.
Yeah.
Shortly after that, the family starts reporting hearing the laughter of an old man echoing throughout the home at night.
That's fucking scary.
Yeah, and then layered on top of that, sometimes they would hear the screams of a woman coming from the bathroom.
No.
Yeah, so just a full soundscape growing up around them.
Mm-hmm. A whole orchestra of nope.
Conducted by Grandpa. And then, to layer into all of this, they start to hear scraping going down the walls in the hallway. On top of that, the family would also report from time to time hearing the sound of laughter, which would morph into, like, wailing, crying. Like, they would just, like, be continual laughter that would just then and like amp up, and you know that there's like a fine line between laughing and crying.
Yes.
So it would just kind of turn into that, and then suddenly when it would get into like full cry, they would just start to hear what sounded like fists punching the walls of the house.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, so a demon just running through having a full teenage shit fit meltdown.
Now, like, I always thought like dark figures creeping in the corner quietly was about as terrifying as it gets, but I feel like these disembodied noises and screams and scrapes is kind of more of a terrifying thing to think about.
Well, just get ready for it, because it doesn't just land in the world of like auditory hauntings for that long. It soon develops into full-blown physical manifestation. So the family would start to experience cold spots around the house, and then suddenly doors would start to open and close and like just slam aggressively on their own, along with appliances just turning on and off on their own without anybody being in the room to have turned them on and off. And then it starts to get even crazier, because one day Maximo, the father, is playing with the baby Maximilian, like the little boy.
Sure, yeah.
When suddenly the baby was picked up by an unseen force and just thrown across the room.
No.
Yeah, just like a full baby toss. Luckily, Maximilian was okay, but everybody was sufficiently terrified by that experience.
Yeah, that's kind of the last straw.
Well, it's not really, because then the parents start to see shadow figures lurching around their room at night. So they'd be laying in bed, and then like Maximo reports that once he was laying there and he could feel someone or something touching all of the exposed parts of his body that like weren't underneath the sheets.
I hate it. That's a real thing. That's a real thing. The blankets will protect you.
Exactly, girl. So like we had a real handsy ghost. And Concepcion got it too. Now the little sisters of Estefania also started seeing shadowy figures. So the two of them shared a room. Their beds were along the same wall with like a little space in between. Both of them suddenly one night are woken up by a loud banging sound. They look out and they see a black shadowy figure slowly crawling across the floor into their room.
I hate it.
A quote from them reads, "We heard a whistling sound like on other nights and then a groan near the door. We were so scared we were frozen. It was then we noticed something on the floor as the light from the streetlights would enter our bedroom and light it up. It was the shape of a man crawling, dragging itself along the floor. He had a black head, no eyes, no mouth, nothing. It was crawling towards us and we started to scream. It was then that the toys that we had on the shelf started to be thrown violently toward the other wall, one by one. And then we heard bangs and shouts." And that's the end of the quote. What the fuck?
Yeah, what the fuck?
Yeah, so the family's kind of like, well, what do we do? How about we install a motion-activated alarm in the house? That'll do something.
Yeah, it'll just go off all the fucking time.
This is kind of what happens. So one night the family is just kind of going about their own business and suddenly the sensor in the hallway starts going off. They run up to see what's there. There's nothing there. This starts to happen with all the other sensors around the house. Even visiting neighbors confirmed all of this shit going on. Like people from the neighborhood would be over just visiting and then suddenly they'd be like, oh, what was that black shadowy figure crossing in the corner? Oh, what's that sound of a woman crying that I can hear in the house?
Wow, so they just, like, these spirits just literally took over this fucking place and they were just amping up. Like, how could you live that way? Like, that would be so terrifying. Like, you can't sleep, you can't just exist. You're afraid that your children are going to be thrown across the room. Like, yeah. What do you do?
And you have neighbors over and shit is literally flying across the room in front of their faces. Now, the physical shit really comes to a head when one night the family is sitting down in the living room. The hallway door that adjoins to the room bursts open as if there was like a giant gust of wind. And they start to hear knocks going up and down the walls of the room that they're in, as well as the hallway. The parents close the door, barricaded with the sofa, and the door ends up getting pushed open again by what the family described as being like a giant gust of wind. So the entire family is blown back, and then they notice that one object was blown into the room with this giant gust that broke down the barricade.
Okay.
What was it? A framed photo of Estefania.
Oh, man.
The mother walks over to the photo. This had been hanging up in their hallway. She picks it up. As she picks it up, it catches itself on fire.
Shit.
And then it just burns itself out. Now, the thing is, it didn't burn the frame at all. It didn't go outside the perimeter of the photo. In fact, it just burnt up the center. It was like a school portrait of Estefania.
Okay.
And it just burnt her, like, body and face.
Fuck. Inside this glass frame.
Yeah. Just like the intro to Bonanza. So...
I binge watched Bonanza one day. Like, I've literally seen Bonanza for one day in my life, but it was like 12 hours of Bonanza.
You've never told me this. I really appreciate knowing this about you.
My parents got digital cable. We had the Western Channel. It was a journey of exploration of TV channels we did not need.
Totally. Then you get where we're at. This whole thing was like ghost Bonanza. So the family is just feeling real fucked up by all this stuff. They're like, this is kind of getting out of hand. We don't know how to deal with this. We haven't been able to get any, like, scientific explanation for this so far. So they call in the ghost investigators. They also call in religious folks, and then they also basically get mediums and then whoever would listen to them.
Sure.
Yeah. So during one of the paranormal investigations of the house, this is about 1992, a medium becomes possessed with the spirit of the nasty grandpa.
Fuck, so grandpa did it.
Yeah, and basically the spirit takes over this medium and they just start attacking one of the women that was there for the investigation. And this all got caught on a news report that ended up getting aired locally in 1992. Like, you can just full on see this guy possessed, supposedly, attacking this woman in a bathroom.
What?
Total douche.
Does this footage still exist?
Yeah, we can post it on Instagram.
Yes, whoa.
Yeah, so when the medium came out of it, he said that the grandfather's spirit was there in the house tormenting them, but then he also noticed the spirit of Estefania there kind of as a guardian trying to protect everybody from grandpa.
So she was like the person at the end of the night who owns the house during the house party, and everybody's just out of control and she's just like, guys, go home. It's time to go home.
Totally. She's like, Les Mis crew, go to bed. Nobody's gonna help you. Grandpa, just put down the pipe. You're done for the fucking night.
Yeah.
Yeah. And another investigator who was doing a paranormal rundown of the house gets an EVP of a woman's voice who they thought to be Estefania saying, beware of grandfather.
God damn it.
Yeah, but in all realness, it probably was just like, and they're like, oh my God, beware of grandfather.
Yeah.
We've all heard EVPs.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah.
Sorry, I'm that bitch. Welcome.
I knew you were.
Mm-hmm. But I love the spooky story, so I don't really give a shit.
Right, suspend your disbelief, girl.
It's gone. Now, the thing is, no matter how many paranormal investigators they got up in the house, no matter how many religious people they brought in the house to bless it and check for demons, everyone was basically just like, yeah, you guys are kind of fucked up on the spiritual level right now. And no, we don't really know how to help you.
Fair enough. I mean, terrifying, but like, yeah, what do you do?
Well, in the case of the Gutierrez-Lazaro family, they basically just stay in the house and they're like, well, let's see where this takes us. And it takes them to November 27th, 1992. So this is the big night, baby. Strap yourself in.
All right.
It all starts with Maximo and Concepcion lying in bed. So everybody's down for the night. Everything seems to be as normal as it can be in the household.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, Concepcion wakes up. She says, and I quote, I felt pressure on top of me, but there was nobody around. I said to Maximo, there's someone here. Then I felt a pair of hands grab my feet and then grab my hand, which were uncovered by the blanket. Maximo is full on J-Lo. He's had enough, he decides to finally call the police. He's like, look, there is a lot of bullshit going going up in here on this good day. I need you to come quickly. We are having some paranormal bullshit and it is fucking with my family in the physical sense.
Damn, he's not like masking it at all. He's just like, there are ghosts. Come help if you can.
Yeah, he's like, get your ass here and shoot this ghost. The thing is, the police initially don't believe Maximo. So Maximo goes full drama. He's like, oh, you don't want to listen to me? Well, listen to the people. And he passes the phone to Concepcion. The girls all come down to the room. They pass the phone around them and they start describing how they saw crucifixes inverting in the house. And then that they saw a big shadowy figure looming at the end of the hallway.
Right.
By the time that the officers have talked to the fourth person, they're kind of like, oh shit, well, maybe we should do something about this.
Yeah, you know, just go and check it out, you know.
So hearing how frightened the entire family was, Officer Jose Negri decides to go out to the home with three other officers.
Right.
Now, according to Officer Jose Negri, it was a really cold night. And when they arrived at the home at about 2:40 in the morning, the entire family was sitting out on the front lawn, like without coats, just completely scared out of their fucking minds.
Right.
So the officers were already kind of like, okay, something is probably going on here. Mm-hmm. The officers come up and the family is just like, I'm sorry, we refuse to go back in the house. After a few minutes of talking, the officers convince the family to come back with them. They sit down at the dining room table and start to talk about what's going on. Now the family starts to explain everything that has been happening. They link it back to the death of Estefania, the unfinished business that she had at the Ouija board, all this kind of stuff. They're like, we think all of this is linked. We've been having paranormal investigators and all this kind of shit in. Like, what do we do? So Officer Negri is just kind of like, okay, well, show me around. Let's see what's going on. Concepcion stays in the dining room with another officer and the daughters. All the while, Maximo, Jose, and two other officers go down to the master bedroom. Now, here's the fun thing. This isn't just word of mouth what we're about to get into. All of this shit that we're about to talk about comes directly from the police report.
Right, because there would have to be a police report.
Yeah, so there was a report written. It's in Spanish. A lot of it's been translated, but it was all corroborated. Like, Officer Jose Negri, who wrote the report, and the three other officers who were there that night all corroborate that all of this happened. So they get down to the master bedroom, and they hear what sounds like a large, heavy boulder crashing outside the room on a balcony. They check out there, and there's nothing. They go back into the family room. Now, here's a quote from the police report. We were found amidst a rare and mysterious situation, that being seated in the company of all the family, we could hear and observe a perfectly closed cabinet door, something which we verified afterward opened suddenly in a completely unnatural way. This started a series of suspicious events that were witnessed by the chief inspector and the three other officers present. So basically, they were sitting around back in the family room after all of these like crash bang booms went on at the other end of the house, mm-hmm. and suddenly the door on the armoire just like flies open on its own. It almost hit one of the officers. He was alerted by another officer who was watching this happen and jumped out of the way before he got hit.
Right.
So the cops run into the middle of the room, draw their weapons and point it at the armoire. There's no one there.
Sure.
After that's happened, two of the cops are just freaked as fuck, leave the house. They're like, we'll wait in the car. We don't want to do this anymore.
Oh, hell.
Yeah. So now it's only Officer Jose Negri and one other police officer who are there for the rest of this shit. The two police officers sit back down with the family and start to talk about what's going on. Suddenly, they start to hear noises coming from Estefania's room. It sounds like loud banging and crashing sounds, like just someone thrashing around in the room. Mm-hmm. They go down to see what's going on, and when they open up the door, they see that the posters that Estefania had up there were shredded apart, like corners still tacked, but just like clawed down the middle.
Right.
Now, there's a room adjoining to Estefania's, so they go into that room to see if the source of these scratches was maybe in that room. Like, they're still trying to find some sort of physical manifestation of all of this. Mm-hmm. Now, to quote the police report, whilst in a state of shock, a powerful noise came from the terrace where we could prove that there was no one present. The suspicious events then increased in quantity and severity, taking the investigation up to an unexpected level. So basically, they go into this master bedroom and they start to hear shit on the patio. patio again, just banging around. Look out there, there's nothing. They come out of the room into the hallway, and then Officer Negri notices that there's like a weird ooze on some of the family's furniture.
Right.
A quote from the report says, moments later, they could hear and see that on the tablecloth on a small telephone table, there appeared to be a brown stain, which the chief inspector identified as a drool.
Ooh.
Yeah, so basically they said that it was kind of like reddish brown in color, and it was just this like weird oozy stain that started to appear on all the furniture in the house. Now, the family had never seen this liquid before.
Yeah.
And then the family is just kind of like, okay, well, let's just get out of this whole little corner of the hallway. This is the part of the house that we don't really go down in anymore, because it was like where Estefania's room was, and it was also where the bathroom was. So they were just kind of like, not our space.
Yeah.
In fact, they start to tell him about the voices that they'd been hearing in the bathroom, along with all the clanging sounds and the temperature changes. And he's like, well, maybe I'll go in and check to see what's going on in the bathroom. So Officer Negri goes in, and he says as soon as he goes in, he feels the hair on the back of his neck start to stand up.
Shit.
Now, the family had told him that they just weren't really using the bathroom anymore. They were using it to store dishes and, like, clean the plates and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
But because of the hauntings, they just weren't fucking with that room anymore. So basically, he goes in, sees that it's just being used for storage, gets this really weird feeling, and is just kind of like, okay, well, the family's not lying to me. So he comes out of there. He has this weird feeling. In the report, it says, during the search of the rooms of the home, the phenomenon which we had been referencing was observed. A wooden crucifix rotated and was ripped off the wall. One of the daughters picked up the crucifix from the floor and attached it behind the door of the room. Suddenly, and strangely, three scratch marks appeared next to the cross.
Shit.
Yeah, so the police saw what the family had been talking about on the phone, where the crucifixes were turning upside down and then swinging back down, and then basically just like on this loop of just like inverted and then going back to normal.
Right.
At this point, the police are basically just like, well, we see this, we hear you, we respect your story, we don't know what the fuck to do about this.
Yeah, I'm sure they didn't have that in police academy.
They're like, look, there's no one for us to shoot, there's no one for us to arrest, you guys don't have any pot, there's nothing that we can really do here to help.
Right.
So they just leave, and the Gutierrez-Lazaro family are just kind of left with this haunting to deal with. And basically, from then on, they're just like, well, the church can't help us, science can't help us, doctors can't help us, the police can't help us. These ghosts obviously fucking hate us. What are we gonna do? They end up selling the house and just moving away, because at this point, that's all that they really feel like they can do.
So after they moved away, were they still being haunted?
No, it basically just all stopped there. So in years since moving away, the family's experienced nothing paranormal. Everything just kind of fell back into place after they moved away. Of course, they didn't have their daughter Estefania with them anymore. Mm-hmm. So things weren't necessarily back into place in every sense of the term, but at least they weren't getting their asses haunted on the daily anymore.
Right. They were in a place where they could maybe learn to move on and carry on with their new normal.
Yeah, and they also put their story out there into the press and talked about it and, you know, made some money off of it, which, you know, like, hey, live your life, do your thing. You just had to uproot your entire family. I'm not going to come for you.
Yeah, mama, it's your story.
Yeah, so fast forward a little bit. The only thing that's got a slight tinge of paranormal that ever happened again involving this case was in 2006. So there was a Spanish paranormal television show called Cuatro Milenio that was investigating the haunting, the possession, and everything kind of inside the house.
Right.
The crew also shot interviews with the family as talking heads at their new homes. When the crew was reviewing the footage for those talking heads that were shot at the new Gutierrez-Lazaro family home,
mm-hmm.
they thought that they could hear the voice of a woman in the background saying, we have not started.
Oh.
Yeah, like completely disembodied. It was when they were interviewing Maximo, so there was not a woman from the family in the room, and it was just completely unexplained. But aside from that, there's never really been anything else that's happened to the family, and even then, that's just kind of an indirect thing.
Right. And do we know anything about the house? Like, did the family that move into the house afterwards, did they experience anything?
No, and we probably would have heard if they said anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, yeah, nothing ever came up of it. The house just seemed to move on its own. I guess Grandpa just wasn't that up to fucking with a new family.
Right. He just really wanted to fuck their shit up.
Maybe he was a ghost with social anxiety. I can identify.
Sure.
It can be hard to adapt to a new team, you know?
Yeah.
So in the years since, this case obviously got a lot of press throughout Spain. And that's kind of the interesting thing about researching this topic, because a lot of the press and articles and all this kind of stuff exist only in Spanish. There are a few translations that are out there, but it didn't really crack into like WASPy consciousness until the movie Veronica came out on Netflix in 2017. It was directed by Paco Plaza. He had heard of this story for many years because it's super famous. It's kind of the only big paranormal experience in Spain that was recorded by the police. And I really think it's one of the only ones in the world.
Yeah, you don't hear about police reports involving paranormal activity too often.
Yeah, and I mean, everyone that was there at the house that night swears that they saw what they saw, and they've never waned from it. So that is the curse slash possession slash haunting of the Gutierrez-Lazaro family.
Wow. I mean, I believe it. Why would they lie? Why would anybody in this story lie?
Yeah, I don't really see any reason for that.
Me either. And going into this story, I actually thought I would have had a good grasp on the things that happened, having watched the movie Veronica, but the movie's quite different than this.
Yeah, they do take some artistic license with it, and Paco Plaza is pretty straightforward about the fact that he does that.
Yeah, I mean, sure, it's a movie.
Yeah, but they did kind of famously immortalize that whole scene with the photo burning up the middle. Like, they recreated that in the film. So, that's everything I know. If I told you anything else, it'd be a lie.
That's fair. That's a good place to end it.
No, and then they started a band and toured around this country, and their name was Nickelback.
Ooh.
Oh, no, that's not a happy ending.
That is like the darkest ending I could ever think for any story ever.
And their name was Radiohead.
Yeah. Sad, melancholy, but okay.
And their name was D-Light.
Yes.
You're welcome. It took me a while, but I got there.
You did.
All right, well, it's your turn.
Yes. And I'm going to be dipping our toes back into that old familiar pond of true crime.
Oh, I love it. Mm-hmm. I'm home.
Yes. So this week, I'm going to be talking about the murder of Bobby Franks.
Ooh.
Yes. So the body of 14-year-old Bobby Franks was found on May 22nd, 1925, after he was reported missing from his Chicago neighborhood the day before.
I'm sorry, can I retract that? Ooh. I'm going to strike that from the record.
Totally fair. You can just sit in silence and in horror. Listen and learn.
Time for the breakthrough.
Yes. So May 22nd, 1924, the body of Bobby Franks is found. Bobby Franks had been bludgeoned to death. Acid had been poured over his face and his genitals in a failed attempt to conceal his identity.
Oh.
Now, I don't know why they had to go to the downstairs to conceal his identity. That just seems like a little bit overkill.
Yeah, girl, no one's identifying him by that. He's too young.
Yeah, but anyway, this is what they did. He had been stripped of his clothes and his body was found in an isolated culvert.
Oh.
Investigations into the crime were led by prosecutor Robert E. Crow, who was a prominent lawyer and also kind of a politician in Chicago. So he just had his little toes in all the legal ponds.
Wow, lawyer politician. Doesn't sound greasy at all.
No, still a combination.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, clearly foul play was definitely involved in the death of Bobby Franks, but the police had little evidence to go on. All they really had was a ransom note that had been addressed to Bobby's wealthy family. They had an eyewitness having spotted a gray sedan idling in the area where Bobby had last been seen, and they had a pair of eyeglasses that were found near the body, which at the time were believed to be Bobby Franks.
Ooh.
However, when a relative came to formally identify the body of Bobby Franks, they pointed out that the glasses did not belong to him.
Okay.
Quickly, police began to determine that perhaps the eyeglasses belonged to the killer. The style of the glasses and the prescription unfortunately proved to be quite common. However, the glasses did have one unusual feature in the hinge. So when authorities inquired about the hinge of these glasses to shops in the area, they were able to deduce that only three pairs of glasses with that hinge had been sold in the Chicago area, which gave them their first list of suspects.
Shit.
Yes. So they looked into these suspects and they found out that one of the three pairs had belonged to a man, but that man had been traveling abroad for weeks.
Okay.
Couldn't have been him.
Two to go.
Another belonged to a woman who had been quickly ruled out as a suspect, which left only one more person, 19-year-old Nathan Leopold.
Okay.
So Nathan Leopold was a wealthy, educated young man. In 1924, his family had a fortune of almost $4 million.
Oh, shit. That's a lot of money back then.
Yeah, that's $4 million 1924 bucks.
Mm-hmm.
Nathan lived with his parents in a well-to-do neighborhood of Kenwood on the Chicago South Side. Being from such a well-off family, the investigators, particularly Robert Crow, were not convinced that Leopold had anything to do with the murder. Like, Leopold was wealthy, so why would he be writing a ransom letter for cash?
He's got that good rich boy morality.
Right?
Of course.
Exactly. But regardless of this, after visiting the Kenwood residence, investigators decided to bring Leopold in for questioning, if anything, to rule him out as a suspect.
They're like, well, may as well do our jobs, I guess.
Exactly. So when Leopold was asked about these glasses, he shrugged and he explained that he had likely lost them during a bird watching expedition.
Totally.
Yeah. Which could have been legit because Leopold had actually written an article and made a small film on the Kirtland Warbler and often went out to the area where Bobby Frank's body was found to birdwatch.
It is pretty flimsy, though, just to be like, well, I'm a bird watcher. It couldn't be me. It reminds me of when I was the lookout for my two friends who were smoking pot. We were 16. We were at a punk show. We went to a neighboring building. And basically, the cops shone their flashlight on us and then, you know, called our parents, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But my friend who had the pipe in his hand when the officer shone his flashlight at us, who then just dropped the pipe next to him and was like, I don't know. I've never seen that before, officer. That is a mighty fine pipe, though, I have to say.
Right.
He then went on to say, I wouldn't be smoking pot. How could I smoke pot? I play hockey.
Right. I wouldn't be able to breathe properly. I'd get short of breath.
Yeah. He was like, my dad's a narc. I could not smoke pot. And he kept saying this. And this is what this fucking guy reminds me of. He's just full on teenage being like, sorry, girl, can't be me.
Right. Had his story straight.
Mm-hmm.
So Nathan Leopold was able to explain away while his glasses were at the crime scene. And as for the night of Bobby Frank's murder, Nathan said he had spent the entire night driving around with his good friend, 18-year-old Richard Loeb.
Oh, great.
So his alibi was that he and Loeb had gone to a park and shared a few drinks. There, they found some girls and spent the night driving around with them. Leopold states that when the girls would not engage in sexual intercourse with himself and Loeb, they dropped the girls off and then headed on home.
He's like, look, we're pigs, but we're not killers.
Exactly. Now, Mama might have been overcompensating for a little bit because all the while Nathan Leopold was being questioned by investigators at the station, the police combed through his room and his belongings, and they ended up finding a letter addressed to Richard Loeb, and the contents of the letter would indicate that Leopold and Loeb were lovers.
Oh, wow. Yeah, he was definitely overcompensating.
Yeah, they were given a little Kate and Leopold fantasy.
Mm, you know what? I love that angle because every boy is gay.
Every boy is gay.
Just so you know.
Right? I started this research not even looking for a queer adjacent true crime story, and it just made itself present anyway.
Yeah, like I hate to break it to you, men in the world, but you're all a little bit pansexual to some degree. Like, let's be real about this.
Yeah. And I mean, girl, this week we watched, what did we watch? We had a little Netflix night. We watched Abducted in Plain Sight,
mm-hmm.
and the dad was talking about how he gave what's-his-face a hand job just because he asked him to.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, manipulation, all of that thing. Okay, mm-hmm. It's all of a part of it. But then we watched the Fyre Festival documentary on Netflix, and Buddy was talking about sucking dick for water.
Yeah, but he was gay.
Oh, he was?
Yeah, no, he's a sister. He's down.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, there's still that one example. Okay, so now, where were we?
Everyone's dad is gay.
Right, everyone's dad is gay.
And the love letter.
And the love letter, yes. So when this love letter was brought to Crow's attention, he quickly determined that, okay, if Kate and Leopold were in fact homosexuals, then why would they be driving around and attempting to have sex with women?
Oh, I wonder why. Because it's a fucking lie.
Because it's a fucking lie. But this is also clearly the thought process of someone who never actually had to confront their sexuality and never understood the layers of denial that can come along with that.
Mm-hmm.
I had a girlfriend in high school, and let's just say I should not have had a girlfriend in high school.
Yeah, I had a few girlfriends in high school, and I'm sorry.
Yes.
To them, I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you're not listening, but I'm sorry.
Yes.
Thank you for being a beard.
So anyway, with all of that said and done, in this instant, Crow was definitely onto something. And so, of course, investigators decided to bring Richard Loeb in for questioning. Now, Richard Loeb was from an established family. His father was actually the vice president of Sears.
Oh.
So his family was worth a lot of money, about $10 million by 1924.
Oh, shit.
Uh-huh. So, like Leopold, Richard was raised by a governess in the absence of his parents, and he also excelled through school. Now, a governess, I guess, is just a fancy name for a nanny.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he did really well in school. He graduated high school at the age of 14 and then immediately went on to university, where he would find camaraderie in Nathan Leopold and establish their friendship.
Oh, yeah.
So Kate and Leopold were an unlikely pair. Leopold came off as this kind of awkward, arrogant person, where Loeb had more of a quiet and captivating presence paired with movie star good looks.
It was Trey Yin Yang.
Trey Yin Yang. Yeah, they were really kind of contradictory in appearance and behavior.
They were like Zoolander and Hansel.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, when Loeb was brought in for questioning, he corroborated Leopold's alibi. But still, Crow thought that there was something suspicious about these young men. And so with their family's cooperation, Crow decided to keep Leopold and Loeb under arrest as the investigation proceeded.
Yeah, lock them in a cell. They'll hate it.
They'll hate it.
Yeah.
So quickly, other circumstantial evidence began to mount. Investigators were able to determine that the handwriting written on the envelope of the ransom note that was addressed to Bobby Frank's parents matched the handwriting of Nathan Leopold on the letter that was found in his room.
Girl.
Furthermore, thinking this may prove their innocence, Leopold's father had sent their chauffeur to the police to explain that the boys could not have committed the murder or have been anywhere near the scene of the crime, because on the night of questioning, Nathan Leopold's car had been in the garage for repairs.
Oh, totally. Because he was out driving it, picking up girls. But at the same time, it was in the garage. But your story's falling apart, Mary.
Exactly. So unbeknownst to Leopold's father or the chauffeur, this information completely contradicted the alibi corroborated by Leopold and Loeb. So Crow knew without a doubt that their alibi was a complete lie.
Love it.
So, equipped with this information, Crow amped up the pressure. He turned things up to 11.
He was like, well, well, well. Looks like things just got 11-gendary.
Oh my god. Y'all watch Drag Race, y'all get that reference, and y'all probably cringed. Just
yeah.
Saying.
Trey 11-gendary.
Yeah.
You gotta say it real slow.
Yeah.
Like you're looking at a camera directly in the eyes.
Yeah. 11-gendary.
And then give a look like, you see what I did there?
Mm-hmm. So during this 11-gendary interview process, Leopold and Loeb were kept in separate rooms for constant questioning.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty boy Richard Loeb was the first to break during these nonstop interrogations. He confessed to the crime and gave details that only the murderer, or in this case, murderers, could have known.
It's always the pretty ones.
Yes. So next, Crow took this information that he got from Loeb and began to question Leopold further. Based on the nature of these questions, however, Leopold determined that Loeb had started to confess. And so now Leopold also began to cooperate. He confirmed the details of the murder, but denied that he had committed the crime, pinning the murder on Loeb.
I didn't kill him, officer. I was just spotting him while he killed him.
Exactly.
Yeah, just making sure that he doesn't fall.
Exactly. So now here we are in a he said, she said situation. Richard is blaming Nathan, and Nathan is blaming Richard. This is that part of the rom-com where things go really bad. You know, things were great, but then I found out you were lying to me. You're not actually a nanny. You are a reporter for a high fashion magazine, and you're writing an article about me. But of course, Crow was eating this up, and the boys continued to talk.
Come on, Alan Carr, chatty man.
Yes. So Kate and Leopold admitted that the crime had taken months to plan, and that they had every intention of getting away with it. Murder was always the objective. Kate and Leopold wanted to be sensational. They wanted to get away with murder, make away with ransom, all because they wanted to prove to themselves and the world that they could do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. To them, it was a game and nothing more. On the day of the murder, they rented a car under an assumed name, and they had also used a typewriter to type out the ransom note, not even knowing who their victim would be.
Girl.
On the afternoon of the crime, Kate and Leopold drove around in their rented vehicle, searching for their victim.
What?
Eventually, they saw Bobby Franks walking alone down a sidewalk in a Southside Chicago neighborhood. Leopold was driving the car and Loeb was sitting in the back when they invited Bobby Franks into their vehicle. They offered him a drive home. Now, that would sound weird, but for Bobby, this would not have seemed so strange. Loeb knew Bobby Franks well, and he was his second cousin.
This is some sloppy ass shit. Like, excuse me, Sloptina Aguilera. Back the fuck up.
Yeah, seriously.
Like, us gays are supposed to be more organized than this. Don't right? you know the gay agenda?
Apparently not. They didn't get the memo.
Fuck.
So anyway, Bobby at first was like, no thanks, I don't need a ride home. Like, I live two blocks down the street.
Yeah.
But then Kate and Leopold were like, well, come into the car anyway. We want to talk to you about your tennis rackets.
Oh, fuck off.
Right? Fucking bougie ass fucking tennis rackets.
And Bobby Franks went for it?
Unfortunately, Bobby Franks did go for it.
Aww.
So it's assumed that immediately upon entering the vehicle, sitting in the front passenger seat, Bobby Franks was killed. He was bludgeoned in the back of the head by Loeb from the back seat with a chisel, and his mouth was stuffed with a handkerchief that eventually suffocated him.
Mm-hmm.
On their way to the dumping site, and with Bobby's body on the floor of the car and out of view, Leopold and Loeb decided to stop for a quick bite to eat. Cocky motherfuckers.
Yeah.
Afterwards, they then poured the acid on the face and genitals of Bobby Frank before stuffing him into the drain at the culvert.
No, ma'am.
So by the time the two men returned to Chicago, word had already spread that Franks was missing. Leopold called Franks' mother, identifying himself as George Johnson. He told her that Franks had been kidnapped and that instructions for delivering the ransom would follow. After mailing the typed ransom note, burning their bloodstained clothing, and cleaning the bloodstains from the rented vehicle as best as they could, they spent the remainder of the evening playing cards. Once the Franks family received the ransom note the following morning, Leopold called a second time and dictated the first set of ransom payment instructions. The intricate plan stalled almost immediately, however, because the body of Bobby Franks was found.
Yeah. Oh, that poor fucking family.
Definitely. Tragic as fuck. So Leopold and Loeb destroyed the stolen typewriter and burned the robe that was used to move the body. And at this point, they were convinced that they had done everything they could to hide their tracks. So they went about their lives as usual until the police first interrogated Leopold about his glasses at his home.
Yeah, you thought you cleaned it up, girl, but you didn't.
Yes, exactly. And investigators were able to put all of this together very quickly because Kate and Leopold had loose lips and they were just giving them everything. They broke down where they bought the murder weapon. They broke down where they rented the car. There was literally a map of their murder by the time they were done talking to them. Like, they literally thought they were going to get away with it, so they just didn't ever consider the consequences of what would happen if they were caught.
They're dumb.
Yes, dumb as fuck. And according to Crow, this case was cut and dry, and it became front page news all across the country. So how two wealthy and educated men commit such a reckless and senseless crime became the question that everybody was asking. But according to Kate and Leopold, they did it because it was fun.
Oh yeah? Really? Yeah.
They had ascribed themselves to Nietzsche's Übermensch, which was a philosophy of a superman who completely masters himself and refutes the conventional moralities in favor of his own values.
Okay, I'm not gonna be that bitch, but...
Did I say it wrong?
You said Übermensch, which I love.
What is it called?
Übermensch.
Übermensch, okay.
But Übermensch is fucking great. I'm pretty sure that's a cafe somewhere.
Übermensch?
Yeah, or yeah. a porn, or yeah. something like that.
Okay.
That is a flexible ass name, and I thank you for it.
Okay, so they subscribe themselves to Übermensch.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, because they followed this philosophy to a motherfucking T and manipulated it to their own insane fantasies, they thought they were untouchable.
Mm-hmm. They were the Ubermenschiest.
Yes, the Ubermenschiest. And during their continued interrogations, Kate and Leopold basically just started to liken their crime to that of an etymologist sticking a pin through a beetle.
Go fuck yourself. I also love that you're just like, we also just did it just because we wanted to prove that we could do it and get away with it. And like, that clearly didn't work out for you, bitch. So way to be tap dancing on the open flames, just trying to come up with something new.
Right. Now it's not just because it was fun, but it was like a thought experiment.
Yeah, totally. Like, how millennial of you? It was just a social experiment, guys.
Yeah, exactly.
This is college guy shit.
Right? Like, So anyway, given these delusional thought processes, Crow began to build his case even further before going to trial, or basically just in preparation of trial, because it's like, these fuckers are going to trial.
Yeah, let's have a fucking weenie roast. Let's get him with every corner of it.
Yeah, so this case hadn't even gone to court yet, and Crow already had this solid evidence. He started collecting testimonies, like 70 of them against the boys, so like, this thing was ironclad.
Love it.
And then Crow decided that the last thing that he needed to do was to block any plea of insanity that may come from the defense, as it seemed to be their only option.
Really? How do you do that?
So he just basically did that by initiating his own psychiatric tests. So he got psychiatrists who were called alienists at the time.
Okay.
Did you know that?
No.
I didn't know that. Alienists.
Okay.
I love it.
Is that what the Netflix series is about? Because I've been thinking it's about aliens all this time, and if it's about a bunch of fucking psychologists, then I'm just going to have to respectfully pass.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly don't know, but I would think aliens.
I'm not pressed.
Anyway, it didn't take Crow very long to collect enough information to prove that Kate and Leopold were perfectly sane.
Mm-hmm.
So, with confessions in place and their sanity proven, Crow had what he thought was an impenetrable case for the prosecution.
Why did you just say he thought he had one?
Well, enter Clarence Darrow.
Ugh.
So hours after the confessions were made public, the Loeb family quickly sought out the legal aid of Clarence Darrow. Mm-hmm. Clarence Darrow was a very renowned defense attorney who became known as the attorney for the damned.
Girl.
So at this point, Darrow was 67 and he had an incredibly successful career. So now nobody was really ignorant in this case. It was very clear that the boys had committed the crime, and there was no way out of that fact.
Mm-hmm.
But the Lowe family just sought one favor from Clarence Darrow. They just wanted him to get the boys a life sentence instead of the death penalty.
So they wanted to be able to like knit him socks for Christmas
for
the rest of his life.
Yeah, exactly. And at this time in 1920s Illinois, the death penalty would be the thing that the prosecution would go for.
Okay.
And Darrow himself believed that everything we do and the people we become are all a result of our upbringing, our childhood, and our parents. So he was very much on the side of nurture over nature, which is like, mama, I don't know about that. But he did believe that capital punishment should not take place at all. He believed that the prime virtue was mercy.
Fair enough.
And this was really not an unpopular thought process at this time, as the death penalty was being abolished slowly throughout the United States after the turn of the century. And because this crime had so much national attention, Darrow saw the opportunity to tip the scales in favor of the abolishment of capital punishment, because the entire country would be watching this unfold.
Okay.
So in the initial hearing, Darrow did as he had been expected and entered a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, and this allowed him several weeks to put together a case to bring before the courts. Now, during this time in which Darrow was building his case, the news media continued to run with the story.
Wow, so basically they were trying to plead the caucasity of it all.
Yeah, exactly. So, because Leopold and Loeb were smart, educated men, some people actually thought that the higher education that Leopold and Loeb received allowed them to think too freely, filling them with wild ideas and delusions of grandeur.
Oh great, the Han Solo defense.
Right, yeah, and all of this news coverage and speculation led Darrow to believe that if this trial was to go forth with a juried sentencing, that Leopold and Loeb would certainly be sentenced to death. And so Darrow gambled on another alternative. So in July 1924, 2 months after the death of Bobby Franks, the court assembled to begin trial. On the first day of court, the room was full but silent. Leopold's father was present each day in court, while Loeb's brother attended on behalf of his family. As the trial commenced, Darrow stood before the court and Judge Caverly to announce that the defendants had elected to enter a plea of guilty, which was not what anybody had expected to happen.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. As the state's attorney, Crow especially had anticipated to argue against a plea of not guilty. But now, Crow would have to argue why Leopold and Loeb should receive the death penalty, while Darrow would argue why they should receive life in prison. And also, now that this was a sentencing hearing and no longer a trial, there was no need for a jury, and the final sentencing would be left up to the judge.
Shit. And the other lawyer was probably like, I had this whole dance routine worked out.
Exactly. But don't worry, Crow still had to go through his whole dance routine. In fact, it took 7 days in court to present his evidence to the courts.
That is a lot of mansplaining.
Yes. And all the while, Darrow chose not to cross-examine any of the witnesses.
How many witnesses?
Probably about 80, I think.
Girl, that's a choir.
Yeah. It was a lot of people testifying in this case.
Okay, no wonder it took 7 days.
Yeah, exactly. And it's basically said that after Crow was done, there was absolutely no doubt in anyone's mind that the boys were guilty.
Yeah, and, like, what else is there for the other lawyer to do? I mean, like, you just gotta walk up there and be like, well, they are little assholes.
Exactly. And when it came time for Darrow to do just that, he basically told the courts that his clients were, in fact, guilty and that they did indeed kill Bobby Franks, but Darrow wanted to expose why. He pointed out to the facts that although each boy grew up with great privilege, they were neglected by their families, raised by governesses, and isolated from their peers. He argued that Leopold and Loeb had a master and servant relationship that led to their extreme dynamic.
Wow, so he's like, look, I'm not saying it's their privilege, but it's their privilege.
Yeah. It's their privilege, but it's also not their fault that it's their privilege.
Oh, totally. Yeah. No, they're just hashtag blessed.
Yeah, exactly. So this trial went on for 32 days, and in the end, Darrow gave a final speech to the court that went on for 3 fucking days.
Girl, bye.
Like, haven't y'all heard enough?
Yeah, come on.
He basically argued that the boys' youth should spare their lives and that although their actions were wrong, they were misguided. He also cited a lot of medical examinations that he had had done before the court, saying that their bodies weren't emitting enough of this, enough of that, that could lead them to commit the crime that they had committed.
Girl, these weenies are roasted. You could have said that in less than 3 days. Put your dick back in your pants.
Definitely. And you can get excerpts of his speech, and mama, he loses the plot a lot, but this is pre-Netflix, this is pre-TV, this is like really kind of before radio drama, so everybody was captivated.
Yeah, totally, and this guy's just filibustering.
Totally. So when it came time for Crow to deliver his closing statement, he argued for the death of Leopold and Loeb. Now, he was also kind of clamoring at this point because without evidence, he accused them of being sexually motivated in the murder of Bobby Franks, citing that their actions were fueled solely by hatred and evil. He also condemned the boys for showing no remorse during the trial. Like, during some of the moments, they were sitting there kind of laughing, snickering, just having a kiki.
Look, they didn't kill him because they were gay. They killed him because they're assholes.
Exactly. Being gay had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, girl.
So after the closing arguments, all that was left was for Judge Caverly to issue his sentencing. It took the judge 12 days of deliberation before the court assembled for his sentencing. The judge discredited Darrow's argument about how the boy's upbringing had led them to commit the crime. He said that the only thing that concerned him in his final decision was the ages of Leopold and Loeb. And because they were so young, and for that reason alone, Judge Caverly sentenced Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb to life in prison for the murder of Bobby Franks alongside a 99-year prison sentence for his kidnapping.
Prison, honey.
Prison, honey. But for Darrow, this was a success as he had effectively saved Kate and Leopold's life.
Good for you.
Now, Leopold and Loeb were initially held at Joliet Prison, although they were kept apart as much as possible Leopold, the two managed to maintain their relationship in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Leopold was later transferred to Statesville Penitentiary, and Loeb was eventually transferred there as well. Once reunited, the two expanded the current prison school system, adding a high school and junior college curriculum.
Look at the gays, just gentrifying.
Right? Coming in there and trading up that space.
They're like, look, we're white gays with privilege. We're doing a musical this year.
Yes.
Move, I'm gay.
It was very Move, I'm Gay. So the men's family initially also sent them money periodically, which they used to purchase goods such as cigarettes and all that, but they also used it to keep other prisoners away from them.
Okay.
So basically other prisoners saw that Leopold and Loeb's families were kind of rich, so they were targeted for threats and robbery.
Girl, they stole your lunch money.
They really did. Some of Loeb's family's allowance actually went to another prisoner, James E. Day, as a bribe not to hurt him. But after Loeb's allowance was reduced, Day was moved away from Loeb because of threats and abuse. Now, on January 28th, 1936, Loeb was attacked by Day with a straight razor in a shower room and died soon after in the prison hospital.
Girl.
Day claimed that Loeb had assaulted him, though he was unharmed, while Loeb sustained more than 50 wounds, including defensive wounds on his arms and hands, and his throat had also been slashed from behind.
Ooh.
But nevertheless, the authorities, perhaps just to, you know, move the paperwork, ruled that Day had been defending himself. A sexual motive for the murder had also been suggested, though there is no evidence that Loeb was a sexual predator while in prison, but Day was later caught at least once in sexual act with a fellow inmate.
Oh, okay.
So now, after Loeb's death, Leopold became a model prisoner. He reportedly mastered 12 languages in addition to the 15 he already spoke, mm-hmm. and made multiple significant contributions to improving conditions at Statesville Penitentiary. These included reorganizing the prison's library by color, I'm sure.
Yeah, totally.
Revamping the schooling system and doing volunteer work in the prison hospital.
This sounds just like a peacocking gay that lost his good D.
The T. Leopold's autobiography, Life Plus 99 Years, was published in 1958, 1 year before a fictionalized film of the crime was released called Compulsion that was adapted from a book by the same name.
Okay.
Now, Mama, get this. After 33 years and numerous unsuccessful parole petitions, Leopold was released from prison in March 1958.
Girl.
He moved to Puerto Rico to avoid media attention and married a widowed florist.
Oh, yeah?
He was known as Nate to neighbors and co-workers at the General Hospital, where he worked as a laboratory and x-ray assistant. He earned a master's degree at the University of Puerto Rico and taught classes there. He became a researcher in the social service program of Puerto Rico's Department of Health, worked for an urban renewal and housing agency, and did research on leprosy at the University of Puerto Rico's School of Medicine. In 1963, he published Checklists of Birds of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. Leopold died of diabetes-related heart attack on August 29th, 1971, at the age of 66. Now, this case went down in history as a pretty prominent case just because of the full, elaborate display. You had these very rich, very privileged people who, why would they ever do this? Their lives were so secure, so people are constantly just trying to get into the minds of these kids. But then on the other side, from a legal standpoint, it was really one of the pinpoints in modern American justice as to whether or not you should sentence somebody to death, give them life in prison, or give them the option to rehabilitate into society.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how throughout history they tend to have these nuanced, empathetic conversations about criminal justice when it has to do with a rich, white, privileged boy.
That's the T, right?
Yeah, where was that heart and soul when you were coming up with mandatory minimum sentences?
Yeah, Mama, that's the T. Let's not forget that these fuckers probably got the amount of leeway that they did because they were white and because they were rich.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's also not forget that Bobby Franks lost his fucking life because of these people, which is why I wanted to call it the murder of Bobby Franks and not the sideshow of Kate and Leopold.
Fair enough. Stick it to him.
Yes, girl.
All right. Well, good one, girl. I'd never heard of that before.
Me either. I was kind of surprised that I hadn't. And I was also surprised of that secret gay twist.
Yeah, and good job. I'll never truly know their real names because all I can think of is Kate and Leopold.
Perfect.
I will forget Leopold and Loeb very shortly after writing the episode notes for this episode.
perfect, as it should be.
You're welcome. All right, well, I guess we're at that point in the show where we ask that iconic 11-gendary question. Tyler, what have you learned this week?
Well, I have said that I've always wanted to experience a haunting, like a true haunting, like a true paranormal experience. Mm-hmm. But this week I learned that I wouldn't know what to fucking do in that situation.
Oh, no?
No. I was just like, my mind kept going to be like, what if this was happening to me? What would I do? And I just kept defaulting to, I have no fucking idea. So I guess what I learned this week is that I would have no fucking idea what to do if I ever found myself in a situation in which I was being haunted.
Fair enough. Good thing that you were in the good graces of your grandfather.
Yes, I was.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I would have to say that this week I learned, don't be a slob Tina Aguilera. Be an integra Tina Turner. So thank you very much for listening, everybody. Oh, you like that?
I like that. Yeah, thank you, everybody, for listening.
Yeah, so if you've been enjoying the episodes and you want to get more bonus content, you can sign up on patreon.com/thatspooky. No matter what tier you sign up at, baby, starting as low as $1 a week, you get access to mini episodes and a whole bunch of other really cool shit.
Yeah.
But we still love you, even if you don't donate. And if you want a completely free way to support the show, you can hop on over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating and a review. You can also probably do it on whatever podcast app you're listening to on.
Yeah, totally. We challenge you to create a review with as many puns as possible. And if you could do that, we'll read it on the show.
Oh, yeah, totally. Welcome to the Punderdome.
Yeah. And make sure you turn those reviews all the way up to 11-gendary.
Oh, yeah. And you can find us on Instagram at ThatSpookyPod. We post photos from the episodes and a whole bunch of other fun shit, too. We are professors of memeology on there. Get into it.
Get into it and then go over and get into Twitter as well. You can follow us there at ThatSpookyPod.
Yeah, you can. And then you can go over to ThatSpooky.com. And get your fucking mind blown with this web excellence that we are laying down.
Yes, eat it. And then if you want to reach out to us, if you want to share one of your own spooky stories, email it to us at thatsspookypod@gmail.com.
Yeah, we have been hearing about people's alien best friends as children. We've been hearing about weird shit that happens to you, spirits that pop up while you're in the shower. And we are just so pleased to hear what horrible, horrible shit is happening to you guys.
Or not so horrible shit, because we also have a story about sex noises being mistaken as hauntings.
Oh yeah, I love that one. We're gonna have to compile them into a real fun episode sometime soon.
For sure.
Yeah, we're cooking something up. Just you wait. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us again, everybody. Can you believe we're at episode 27? I can't.
I can't either. And hopefully this won't be the last, so we don't find ourselves in the 27 club.
Yeah, but truly, I just haven't been able to believe in anything in a long time. All right. Well, on that note, we love you all very much. Did you get eyelash extensions or is that just natural? Oh, it's just natural.
It's just natural.
Oh my God. You're blessed.
Wow.
Every week, you just keep coming to the table with more and more. We truly have beautiful listeners.
Totally. Y'all turning the looks.
Love it. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Kissy kisses.
Kissy Christmas.
Mm-hmm. It's always holiday time here. And don't forget, if you're going to be a bitch,
be a spooky bitch.
Bye.
Bye.